Ladies and gentlemen, Teresa Eamon. She has been here for, I don't remember how many years, but she's a huge part of Warbirds of Review. Yes, please. They'd give you a standing ovation if they thought they could. If you'd come back, maybe later you're going to be here, maybe? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Connie Boland. I am the founder and now the coordinator for Warbirds in Review. And I'm going to take a few minutes this morning. Kyle Guyatt is actually the one who takes care of all the people, all the details. She makes my job so much easier than it would be otherwise. It'd be impossible. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a hand to Kyle Guyatt. She works so hard. There are a lot of people behind the scenes. And speaking of behind the scenes, we have the Sleeping Dog production crew that are professionals at what they do. And we produce a world-class event. I mean, we are an event, and we in Warbirds are the place to be. And I thank all of you for making this such a success. And let me see, we have somebody writing a smiley face above us for those of you who aren't here. But our production crew is amazing. Today, with the streaming of Lucky, because he could not be here, Lucky Luckadoo is actually going to be on the Jumbotron here, including the camera that we're using for Lucky. This crew has 9 cameras running today. So Sleeping Dog Productions, headed up by Kyle Guyatt. Kyle keeps everybody straight, including her husband, Scott, most of the time. So we thank all of them. To Scott's Miracle-Gro Company, they are the reason that we are able to hire this production team and bring it to you. Scott's Miracle-Gro is the sustaining sponsor, but without Ron and Diane Fagan and the beautiful building we have behind us, we would not have the production room and the ability to do this. Today's program is about the greatest generation. In a few minutes here, you're going to hear from 3 gentlemen whose paths in the service were quite different. We're going to try to blend those together, but those 3 stories are standalone, with each of these gentlemen going to serve their country in their own area of expertise. We have Lucky Luckadoo, and here in just a few minutes, General Ed McElhenney, who is our moderator, will come out to introduce the 2 gentlemen that we have on hand here in person. And before that, I'd like to say thank you to all of the aircraft owners who have allowed us to use their aircraft this week, and to all the volunteers who have made this possible. It would be impossible for me to name all of them, but that includes the flight line crew, the aircraft owners, once again, the presenters, the family who have helped us in getting the family members here to be part of our presentations. This afternoon's show was scheduled to be the Tuskegee Airmen, and we were very fortunate to have planned for 2 airmen to be with us, along with the Red Tail P-51 that is in the Tuskegee scheme. Unfortunately, those 2 gentlemen are unable to join us, and so we have canceled the 1 o'clock show today. So for those of you who are expecting a 1 o'clock Tuskegee Airmen feature this afternoon, we have it's necessary. This happens. Flexibility is the key to air power, they say, and we have been very flexible all week. Airplanes make it, some don't, and some of the people have to cancel, so we appreciate your understanding. So this will actually be our last Warbirds in Review presentation for 2023, and it promises to be a really good program, so please direct your attention to the Jumbotron, and we'll get on with the show. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, as we bring out the greatest generation, as you welcome them, I would like to tell you that this afternoon we will replay during the 1 o'clock hour the presentation of a few years ago with David Hartman and General McGee with the Tuskegee Airmen. That will be live streamed, and it will also be playing here on the Jumbotron, a replay. And welcome, sir. Thank you for being here.
I can sit on there.
Okay, there.
No. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Crowd's noisy.
That's fine.
That's fine.
Well, he brings his own chair.
Yep. Just pull up a little bit. There we go. Got her.
All right, we got it.
I'll put this right. I'm going to have to go around you.
All right. We appreciate your patience. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the last Warbird in Review for 2023. I'll say now this is the last and the best with the gentleman that we have here and also up on the big screen up there. I'm Ed McElhoney. I'll be your moderator along with an assistant today, Larry Kelly, who also owns this beautiful B-25 right here. So Larry and I are going to be doing kind of a tag team a little bit. We'll be asking some questions, but the bottom line is we would like these members of the Greatest Generation to do most of the talking. I will introduce them by age. And the first... And if y'all were here last year, you might recognize the guy on the screen over there. His name is John Lucky Luckadoo, 101 years old. Is that right now? I think we're up to 101. So that's Lucky. He was a member of the Bloody 100th. And he'll tell you stories about that, but he was a B-17 pilot, and he successfully made 25 missions in World War II and survived to be here. Number two, in terms of chronology, I think we've got our last man down here, Mr. Verbanek. He's a lieutenant when he fought. I think he's 99 years
99.
Old.
99.
So Carl Verbanek is 99 years old. And the youngster of our group is Bob Holmstrom here, staff sergeant when he flew. And I think, Bob, you're what, 97?
97.
Okay, so he's only 97 years old.
Thank you.
The program that we've got today, we've got these three great individuals, and each one has got their own stories. So we're going to kind of separate it. Each one will have his own time. At the very end, we'll get Larry to talk a little bit about the airplane, and then we'll open it up to questions. So with that, we're going to start with Lieutenant Carl Verbanek at the end. And by the way, Brittany's is granddaughter, and she's going to be assisting today. And we'll first begin by just telling you a little bit about how he was trained. He was a B-26 bombardier navigator, is what
right.
he was by training, but that's not how it ended up. And Carl, you want to start just by telling us a little bit about how you got into that B-26 and then what you ended up flying after that?
Transition training, B-26s, our crew, we were on our way to pick up our new airplanes in Florida. We had been training in Barksdale Field in Louisiana. We loved our airplanes. We thought that the 26 was the greatest thing there was. And anyways, on a train trip to Florida, somebody come up down the aisle looking for me and another navigator. We were yanked off the train, put on another train to go to West Virginia. Our crew went down to Florida, got their airplanes, I was replaced by an ATC navigator. They one step above what I was. They were trained with celestial navigation, which is a little something you might need when you're crossing the ocean and you have no landmarks to know where the hell you are. You got to work off the sun, and that gets you your directions and where to go.
So they were ferrying.
Anyways, I was sent to West Virginia to pick up a ride on a Liberty ship. There's something else. 30 days on the ocean to get to Africa. My crew had gone down Florida, down to Brazil, across the ocean, landed in Africa, and I was bobbing around the waves. But the trip they took along when they left Africa, headed north, someplace alongside of Portugal, a mid-air collision, and my crew was gone. And the poor navigator that took my place, he was gone too. But I didn't know this until we landed in Africa at Oran. Now this place, this camp, you wouldn't believe, but it was a war camp. Everything is like you'd see in World War I trenches. Trenches 6 foot deep, you couldn't see over the top. And little rooms were carved out of the ground. And probably four or five double-decker cots, and I don't know how many places like this were carved out, but we waited for a ship, a beautiful British liner, picked us up, took us to Naples. This was my first sight of what war was. Bombed out everything you wouldn't believe. People all over dying. No place to go. Anyways, we were shipped up to a place, a replacement depot. This is when I found out my crew was gone, and we sat around Naples for about a month. I finally got it signed to a B-26 outfit. When I got there, it had all been converted to B-25s. This is what I flew my missions in. I didn't get to fly many, but I had one mission that I'd like to tell you about. It was in about the middle of December, 1944. We flew out of Corsica to Raggia. Was the name of our air base. And we flew all the way across the north central. Part of Italy. And we come out on the Adriatic side above Venice, and before he got that far, you could see in the sky airplanes. I didn't know it until we read about it in the little newspaper, I forgot the name of it. But anyways, it was a 1,000 airplane raid. B-17s, B-24s, B-25s, P-51s, the Red Tails. You could see these airplanes maybe 10 miles away. They were streaming up along the Adriatic, heading for the Palestine air oil fields. And we knew that was a pretty tough place to go, not knowing that the place that we were going, we would join the group until we got to the northern edge of Italy, and then we cut it back west to a place called the Brenner Pass, the railroad yards. The Brenner Pass was one of the very few places or routes that the Germans used for supplies to take care of their forces in Italy. The railroad yards or marshaling yards, they would put together trains, move them out at night. They couldn't do much traveling in a day because our planes were always looking for them. Yeah. And what we were doing on this mission was to bomb up the yards. Was fantastic. The Germans had us nailed, flak like you would see over Germany would on front of us, just strings of flak straight ahead. We were bouncing around. Of course, I didn't know what the hell was going on. But anyways, on the way back, we cut through Italy and back out over the Mediterranean to Corsica. On the way along the Corsican coast, two planes had to go down they shot up too bad. And we were on the tail end of our group. A pilot asked if we could break out of our formation and watch these guys. And we threw out a life raft. We could see them, the parachutes. The planes were floating, but some of the crew had dropped out with parachutes. We watched those chutes, one after another, disappear, and the guys were gone. We made it back to our airbase, got out of our airplane, and the crew was running around it like mad. They counted 27 holes in it. And my pilot thought, well, he told me it was rougher than you think. And that raid was about the highlight of my flying career in Italy. Most of the other places were railroad bridges, warehouses, and things like that. We never encountered that the problems of flying in real terrible flak German. They really had guns that really get to you. And they knew how to do it.
Thank you. That what can I say? You survived.
You survived.
And we thank you for the mission. I have to point out something special on his left wrist right now, though. And his compliments of Larry. It's something that's just temporary, but we were inside. And you saw the film. Carl flew the B-25, you know, and you heard that he trained in a B-26. Then he gets over there. His crew is gone. He ends up in a B-25 that he never even trained in.
Yes.
But in that film, you saw Jimmy Doolittle, the raid on Japan. And Larry was wearing this watch. And, I'll let you tell the story. He said, no, I don't need to wear this watch. He said, this gentleman needs to wear the watch. So, Larry, go ahead.
Well, back in 1992, Jimmy Doolittle, when he had a meeting with Don Penny Snyder, who had been assisting him, Gerald Ford had introduced him, and Gerald Ford was a good friend of Don Penny Snyder. Worked for Gerald Ford as director of communications in the White House, and there was this big reception, and General Doolittle was there, and Gerald Ford asked Don could he help the general with some speech writing. The two of them wound up being great friends. They found out they lived only three blocks from each other. And for years, their friendship was very, very close. In 1992, one day in the office when the Snyders were there helping the general with some correspondence, Doolittle opened his drawer and took this wristwatch out of the drawer and handed it to Don and said, here, you take this. Said, Air and Space Museum wants this, but I don't want to have them. They'll put it in a box and file it away, and nobody will ever see it again. So you keep this and keep the story of my boys going. Don asked him, he said, is this the watch you wore on the raid? It's a Charles Lindbergh invented Longines hour angle watch. It was given to Doolittle in 1939. And he said, yes. And so it's been a prized possession of Don until last November when he passed it to me to be the next caretaker. You don't own something like Jimmy Doolittle's wristwatch. You become a caretaker. My charge is to find the next caretaker and to continue to keep the memory alive. And I bring it to events like this to share with other pilots. But sitting in here and finding out that he flew B-25s in combat, I said, it's appropriate for you to wear this today, not me. So that's the wristwatch that he's wearing today. It was Jimmy Doolittle's wristwatch. And ironically, when he was with 12th Air Force, Jimmy Doolittle was his commander.
Thank you, Larry. And yeah, Carl, I think you're going to have to give it back. That's all I can say.
Well, okay. maybe a little later.
All right. Next, we're going to go to our guest that is joining us via Zoom. And there he is. And there's Lucky. I'll preface this with his book. It's called Damn Lucky. Outstanding read. I wrote it. I read it last year. Great stories. And Lucky, I'll just say thank you so much for being here. I told him earlier, it doesn't look like he's aged another year at all. He looks great. Again, he's truly speaking, I wish we could have an entire program for each one of these individuals. Unfortunately, we can't. But Lucky, I'm going to just ask you what you want to bring out here. He was a member, as I said, of the Bloody 100th. That was the bomb group that if you were sitting there in a briefing and you had four guys sitting there, hey, one of those guys was going to come home. The other three were either going to be missing in action, prisoners of war, or passed away. So, Lucky, I'll open it up to you. And where do you want to go with this? What would you like to bring out to this crowd right now?
Well, I'd like to thank you first for having me, even though this is somewhat remote. It is a pleasure to join you, even on Zoom, and share some of my experiences of 80 years.
Uh-oh, technical difficulties. Flexibility is the key to air power. Let's see if we can get this resolved at this point.
Over
there he is.
To celebrate the anniversary, the 80th anniversary of my very worst mission, which was the beginning of what became known as Black Week during 1943, when the 8th Air Force pulled out all of the stops and we put up a maximum effort in an attempt to bring the Nazi war machine to its knees. We suffered horrendous losses. And as a consequence of that, but one of the things that I'd like to point out to you is that both the Japanese in the Pacific and Hitler in the European war grossly underestimated the ability of the United States to outproduce the world. This is what spelled our victory. Hitler did not believe, nor did Hirohito believe, that we could replace our losses, that they could inflict such serious damage to our forces that we would never be able to recover. We not only recovered, but we outproduced anything the world had ever seen before or since, or will ever see again. And this is how we prevailed and how we won World War II, is that we were able to train our troops, our crews, our air crews. We were able to produce with impunity because we were protected by the Atlantic Ocean on the east and by the Pacific on the west. And we were not harassed day and night by bombing, as both the Japanese and the Germans were. I would like to point out that myself, as well as my comrades, were citizen soldiers. We were going up against an formidable enemy, certainly in Europe, that was so far better experienced, and better equipped than we were. And they'd been fighting for 4 years. So they knew what they were doing, and they had perfected their techniques, and they were extremely effective. And we were going up against the pros. We were playing in their backyard. Britain, or all of Europe, was completely occupied by the Nazis when we got to Europe in the summer of 1943 and began confronting them and trying to bring them to their knees, which we eventually did, as you know. But why the group that I was assigned to became known as the Bloody Hundred is due to a number of reasons, not the least of which was that when we lost crews, we lost big. In the raid that I mentioned that was my worst was my 22nd to Bremen, on October the 8th of 1943, we sent out 18 airplanes from the 100th Bomb Group. We lost 12 out of that 18 on the bomb run. Between the initial point and releasing our bombs, I brought what was left of the group, which was a mere 6 airplanes, home by rallying them and back into formation and attaching on to the following wave of the 95th Bomb Group that particular day on that particular mission. They had lost a complete squadron, and so we filled in for their losses, and that was the one mission that I really seriously doubted I was going to survive.
Lucky,
I'm now 101 years old, and thank God for every day that I have survived. I'm not a hero. I am a survivor. I happen to be the last remaining original 100th Bomb Group pilot still standing. And so I am frequently asked to speak about my experiences to school children, to third generations, and to make them aware of the tremendous sacrifices that were made by my generation, or they wouldn't be here. None of us would be here. So that is my contribution to serving my country in time of war, which was necessary. We had no choice. And unknown to all of you, because you weren't here at the time, all of America was united behind the war effort. Unlike anything that we've ever seen before or since. And unfortunately today, the oath that we took when we accepted service and were enlisted was to protect our values against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. And today, we are being betrayed from within. So it's necessary for current generations to be made aware of the sacrifices that are required to protect our freedoms and be thankful that we're able to do so. And it is my sincere hope that current generations will pick up the cudgels and insist that our values be honored and that we wave the flag with pride. God bless America.
Thank you so much, Lucky, for those words. And I'll just say, some folks might not understand those losses. You talked of airplane losses. Tell them what you lost with one airplane, how many crew members there were.
In the B-17, we had a crew of 10. And as a 21-year-old, believe you me, I went overseas as a co-pilot and was therefore the second in command of my crew. They took 40 of us from my flying school class, newly minted pilots, directly from flying school, and stuck us into the right seat of a B-17. We had never been in a B-17 before. And this was just before going to war. We did not have the benefit of pre-combat training that the rest of the crew did, but we were suddenly placed in this position of responsibility for not only our own skin, but 9 other crew members. So believe you me, even though we were hairy-headed college kids, we grew up in a hurry.
Thank you. All right, Lucky, I'm going to ask if you can hang with us for another 20 minutes here or so. There's going to be some questions for you, I'm sure. But I want to get to another one of our honored generation kind of guys here. And that is Bob Holmstrom. He didn't write this book. The name of the book is Warbirds in the Cloak of Darkness. He was sworn to secrecy for 40 years and couldn't say anything about what he really did. His official position was tail gunner in a B-24, staff sergeant. What did he end up flying? Well, he went to Europe, went to England, black airplanes. You probably never even knew we had black air. I mean, literally, they painted these airplanes black. They modified them somewhat and then sent them on these missions. The mission code name was Carpetbagger. And you'll see he's got some patches there. It talks about the carpetbaggers. And he's going to describe some of those missions. But basically, it was a B-24 that flew low altitude, at night, alone, armed. But as he said, I don't think they ever fired a shot in anger.
Right.
He got shot at a lot. But what his mission was to supply the underground and the folks behind the lines with guns, equipment, pigeons, people. They did all those things. So I'm going to let Bob talk a little bit about that mission and the highs and lows of it. So Bob, tell us about being a carpetbagger.
Well, being a carpetbagger was an opportunity to really help our country. We trained to learn different languages because we were flying from England over to Denmark, Germany, France, Belgium, up to Norway. And I flew as far over as Russia and Switzerland on some of our long trips. And on those trips, We flew several dog legs all alone at night when the moon was out only. Only when the moon was out. We had to see the ground where we were going for navigation. And we would fly several dog legs to mislead the Germans, maybe 5 or 6 dog legs, so the Germans wouldn't know our target that we were going to supply the underground. When we got our plane loaded in England, it was loaded with containers that, if you can see my arms, about this big around, and the containers were made out of real heavy cardboard, and they had about 7 feet long, and they had a bumper on the bottom, a cushion, so that when the container hit the bottom, it wouldn't destroy the material that we were serving to the Patriots. And it had a white parachute on it. The material that we dropped supported many, many groups of underground. Some of the underground groups were 25, 30 people. Some were 200. Now, those people never lived in the town. They lived in the mountains, in the woods, any place they could hide so that they could harass the Germans. In those containers were dynamite, so they could blow up telephone poles, railroad tracks, bridges, stuff like that. They would sneak out of the woods and do that. There was medicine in some of them, radios, so they could contact Europe. They also had machine guns and hand grenades, clothes that people needed, anything to survive just like you would today and tomorrow.
But wait, I got to stop you. You talked about radios, but weren't there some pigeons in there too?
Well,
what were they doing?
That was a different flight, but one trip was over by the Danube River, and my pilot would fly his route following the river. But the pigeons were in a carton like a Quaker Oats oatmeal box. Had 3 days of food for the pigeons. It had a pencil in there and capsules, so the Patriots, when they got the pigeons, would write down their message, their orders, groceries, medicine, or whatever they needed, and release the pigeon, and the pigeon would fly back to England. Sometimes it was a couple days, maybe 3, and that pigeon, carrier pigeon, would always make it back again. In that, when we threw the, when I would safety strap myself on the side of the ship and open up the trap door, I would, my waist gunner would hand me each box, and I was told by the navigator when to throw it out. I would lean out and actually be out below the airplane bottom. And that box with pigeons in it would explode at 100 feet with a barometric fuse with a small parachute, so the pigeon would land safely. And many times we'd be banked 90 degrees and we were that low going on down the river, and I would look up to the side and 200-300 feet higher was a German castle. Now that was kind of scary, but it had to be done, and we helped so many people in that way. It was all humanitarian. I was so happy about that when the war was over, that we really helped people, never killed anybody.
But you also lost some airplanes, didn't you? Not all your carpet baggers made it back, did they?
No, not all of them made it back. When we lost an airplane, we lost 10 people, of course. And when we made a trip, there was no radio communication. When we took off from our runway, we were all alone, like I say, in the dark with the moon shining. There was no communication, no fighter planes. No one knew where we were going except my navigator and my pilot. I wasn't privileged to know until we got about halfway to our target. Then I could find out what happened. The longest trips that we made were something like 10 hours. Now, in the winter of 44 and 45, that was the coldest winter there ever was in Europe in 100 years. So sometimes it was 40 below zero when we were flying, but we had electric suits, boots, clothes. So it was pretty good as long as those suits could be heated. Some of them went out and it was just survival, I'll tell you. It was pretty cold. The oxygen mask would freeze to our face and we would look like chimpanzees with the thing on there. It was something different. Another thing, we're flying at night. The Germans really didn't pay too much attention to a single plane flying overhead. Sometimes an ME-1209 would come up and fly maybe 300-400 yards to our right or left and wiggle his wings and turn and fly away. Wouldn't even shoot. The next time you better look out because the next guy is going to be shooting. But it was just that way. All the Germans weren't bad. Germans were good, some of them. On some of our flights, we just dropped leaflets in containers. And at that time, we would fly only about 18,000 to 20,000 feet high. And those containers contained messages for the underground. It called some for false information for the Germans, so we could maybe send them the right wrong way and tell them different things and tell the German people actually what was happening in the war, because Germany censored their people so well that they couldn't get any messages from the outside. So, and we heard about those leaflets later after the war, and it was really something. That leaflets were dropped from those, like I say, 20,000 feet. At 10,000 feet, a barometric fuse would blow that capsule all to pieces, and those leaflets would spread out and cover a 30-square-mile area. So the Germans couldn't run around and pick them up and burn them and destroy them before the population seen them.
How about, your missions where you were dropping supplies or weapons, was at night, obviously, how was it marked? Were there obviously probably not lights, but maybe fires, or yeah. What did they use to got yourself in the area, but good navigation, obviously, but then, hey, what were you looking for?
When we were supplying the underground with those supplies, we looked and we had a time frame within about 5 minutes at a spot where we were going to drop. The Patriots knew we were coming. They built three fires in a row and one off to the side, or else they used flashlights and did the same. We made the drop on the side where the single light was. We would pass over at 500 feet, 450, whatever, so we could get down, and we'd have to slow up to below 120 miles an hour next to stalling speed. So when the capsules were dropped, they wouldn't rip the chutes. So, and so all their stuff would be safe.
Okay.
And then we'd turn around and make a circle and fly back to Germany and look for those white cliffs of Dover when we come back.
All right, I'm going to stop for now and turn it over to Larry and just get him to talk a little bit about this beautiful airplane that we've got here. He's owned it for quite some time. He's got thousands of hours in it. So, Larry, give us a clue about this beautiful B-25 that we're using the shade for right now.
Well, let me tell you a little bit first about the original Panchito served with the 396 Bomb Squadron, 41st Bomb Group, 7th Air Force in the Pacific. And you see the name Don Seiler under the window on the left. And a special story is about why that's painted on there. But when this particular airframe was built in late 1944, it was too late in the war. It never was assigned to a unit used for a transition, and then it wound up going to storage, and then it was sold in 1960, and turned into a fire bomber. We have some come by and see us a little later on. We'll show you some photo books of the restoration of the airplane. It was used as a fire bomber. Then later it went down to Florida, where it was used. The Howell brothers mounted a Volkswagen motor back in the waste gun area, powering a pump. They mounted spray bars under the hard points under the wings, and they sprayed orange groves and mosquitoes. And, of course, the DDT they were using to spray back then just corroded the airplane. It was abandoned. It was donated to and basically abandoned outdoors at the SST Museum, St. Cloud, Florida. In 1981, the museum went defunct, and the airplanes were all sold. All the assets were sold. Tom Riley got the airplane, took the wings off, towed it to his restoration shop, and over the next 6 years, he and his crew worked professionally to restore the airplane, and the three gentlemen that owned the airplane and was paying for the restoration, their pastor at their church back in Texas was a gentleman named Bob Miller. Bob Miller and his identical twin brother Bill were the two turret gunners on Panchito, the original Panchito, serving in the Pacific. Now, Don Seiler, I mentioned his name. Don had volunteered, was trained as a pilot, first pilot, meaning the command pilot. Served his first combat tour with the 41st down in the Solomon Islands, and by late 1944, the Japanese problem in the Solomons was pretty much taken care of. 41st Bomb Group was brought back to Hawaii to get outfitted with new aircraft. They got new. They flew G models with a cannon in the nose of them, a 75-millimeter cannon, a Sherman tank gun, is what they flew down in the Solomon Islands. But now they got these brand new, beautiful J model airplanes, and yes, they were not painted. Well, why did you stop painting airplanes? It slows down production by a week. It adds 600 pounds to an airplane, so that's one less bomb you can carry and a lot less fuel you can carry. Why did you need paint? So. It's the way the airplanes looked with his beautiful bare metal B-25. So he and his buddy Ben Tarnauskas, who had trained together, they went to see, to the base theater, they went to see The Three Caballeros. You may have seen it. It's a Disney animated movie from late 1944. Well, they knew then what they were going to paint on their airplane. Bob could see himself, Don, as this Mexican rooster shooting off the 2.6 guns. And Ben Tarnauskas, the romantic, he could see himself as Carioca Joe, the green parrot from Brazil. He painted that on his airplane. And off they went to Okinawa. And when they arrived on Okinawa, Don Seiler was the senior combat pilot in the 396 Bomb Squadron, the old man. He was the most experienced, the one the new pilots had to fly with before they could fly with their own crews in combat. He was 22 years old. How many of you out there are 22 years old? Okay, I see a couple of hands go up. Yeah. Imagine being the old man, the most experienced guy, and being responsible for the lives of so many young men. But I had the great honor At Mid-Atlantic Air Museum one year, a number of years ago, we met Bill Miller. He comes walking up, shows me a picture, and it sort of caught me, caught my breath. When I said, now I've got a connection to the original pilot, original crew of the original airplane. And a couple months later, I met Don Seiler's kid brother at the Akron Air Show. And then I had a connection to the officers. And I found out that Don had died in the early 1980s from a brain tumor. He had two young boys. These two young boys never really knew their dad. But I found out that both had grown up to be aeronautical engineers. And Don's wife was still alive and doing very well. They had never met any of the enlisted that had flown with Don in Okinawa, or even in the Solomons. Don had kept a very detailed diary. Excuse me, Bill Miller had. And in that diary was entry after entry after entry about what a wonderful man Don Seiler was. No one ever had a spark plug foul on him when they were flying with Don Seiler. He was one that they all wanted to lead the missions. So here was these two young guys, that young men, had grown up, never really knew their dad. So we invited Ruth and the boys to join us at the Cleveland Air Show in the fall. And Bill Miller came along with his diary. And this is what Warbirds is about. They're sitting on the tailgate of a pickup truck, parked under the airplane the day before the air show started. These two boys, who are now grown men with their own family, and Ruth, remembering her husband, they sat and learned firsthand, not from some historian who had rewrote history from what he thought may be accurate, but from the man who actually flew combat with their dad, their husband, you know, in Europe. That's what Warbirds of America does, is keep that connection, that history alive to the greatest generation. These gentlemen here, you know, when I had the honor of getting General Doolittle's wristwatch, you know, to be the caretaker of that icon, we're sitting in here, I said, this is not appropriate for me to wear out here today. That's why this gentleman was, because he flew under the command of General Doolittle during the war. But the B-25, just shy of 10,000 of them were built, medium bomber. Early in the war, they were taking tremendous losses in the Pacific. Now, the B-25 was used in every theater of the war by all the Allied air forces. They were used as a medium bomber, but it really gained its fame, not only on the Doolittle Tokyo raid, where 16 were used. If you ever heard the story, you say, well, it was a suicide mission. You ask any one of the Doolittle Raiders was a suicide mission, they didn't think so. That was not what they were trained for. They were trained for the mission to land, go to Chuchao, China, land, refuel, fly on to Chungking, and the aircraft were going to be donated or given to the Nationalist Chinese and Claire Chennault, the Flying Tigers, and this is going to make up the bomber command. The B-25s from the Doolittle Raid were going to make up a bomber command for the Flying Tigers. But early in mid-part of the war, when we were getting such heavy losses, if they were bombing a ship, they'd be at 10,000 feet. They'd drop the bombs. The Japanese commander could look up and say, oh, okay, well, let's just turn right, and the bombs would miss. They were getting shot down and taking heavy losses. But Pappy Gunn, salty sort of feller, and Jack Cox from North American Aviation decided they were going to start modifying them. They needed something to do low-level attack. They started adding more and more machine guns. By the time the J models were built, you notice there's a seam right here where you can take one nose off and put another one on. On the J models, you could have as many as 8 50-caliber machine guns in the nose, 2 in each one of the package guns, 2 in the top. Count them up. That's 14 forward-firing 50-caliber machine guns. And by the way, you put 4 of them wing abreast. Count them up. That's 56 50-caliber machine guns. Line them up, coming over a Japanese airfield, 330 miles an hour. As they say, balls to the wall, wide open, throttles to all the way up. Treetop level, the Japanese turned their machine guns up. It's like trying to run under a waterfall without getting wet. They were getting hit. They were getting shot up. The 345th at one time, the Air Apaches were taking as heavy losses as 20% losses a day. But yet going back into combat the next day after sleeping all night in the swamp, getting eaten up by mosquitoes, eating rancid food, getting up, going again, the mechanics working all night. There was a mechanic for the 345th one time. He told me, he said, you know, without us, them pilots, they just another mouth to feed. These guys work all night long to keep the airplanes flying. But imagine the firepower then. So the B-25 really gained its fame later in the war when they were used close air support, ground attack, very, very effective then in the role as a strafer. There was one young man one time, again, another 345th bomb group story, and then I'll give it back to you, Ed. But it's an interesting story. They came back from a mission. The left engine was feathered. Cowling was all busted up. It landed, and you can't taxi a B-25 without both engines running because the nose wheel is a free-castering nose wheel. I see Nadav here. He learned that when he went through our flight school. Kara and Sabrina over here, they learned that when they learned to fly with us. So all he could do was land and roll off the end. Well, this was supposed to be a milk run. They'd shot this airfield up day after day after day. So the CO comes running down a Jeep, gets out of the Jeep, this boastful says, what the hell happened to you? Big, tall Texan, he said, well, sir, we hit a bird. He said, how the hell could a bird do that much damage to an airplane? He was sitting in a tree. That's a true story. The first time I heard that, I thought that had to be made up, but I heard that story later on from someone else.
I love it.
True story. But it defines what the role was of the B-25 later in the war.
Well, I just got to ask Bob here. You were talking about the number of guns that were on your airplane. Well, you had a crew of 10 on the B-24, and how many 50 calibers you have on that thing?
We had 20 50 caliber machine guns
on
this. So
that's not bad, you know. No. 20 50 cals on that thing. And that was a standard airplane, correct?
Right.
All right. All right. I'm going to open it up to questions right now. I know we're over. I haven't seen my sign yet that says stop. So I'm going to open it up to questions now. And questions for anybody in the audience here.